You're listening to the podcast with a K, available on Stitcher.com, Audio Boom, thepodcast.co.uk, and iTunes. And if you are listening, I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley. With me are James McLean and Brian Terranova. This week, we're not talking so much about Doctor Who. This may come as a surprise to some of you, particularly you, Stephen. So we're not talking about you this week, so you can go. X-Files. We're looking at the X-Files. I'm a bit of an X-Files. I'm not an X-Files virgin. My experience with the X-Files has been of a sort of a casual viewer, and I really cannot remember watching many episodes past the second or third series, certainly. Back in the day, and James will agree with this, probably, unless my recollection is wrong, the BBC started it off on a Thursday evening, and then after sort of series three onwards, they started moving it about a bit. And when it was first on, I was at college, and then I was working in a bar, so I tended to miss the X-Files unless I was at home. So we'll talk a bit about that later. I just wanted to bring something up, however. Guys, it seems we've got a slight identity crisis with the podcast with a K.
Go on.
Well, you see, I was talking to one of my wife's colleagues, regular listeners may recall that my wife works in politics, and this particular person, who will remain unnamed, offered me some sort of their bafflement, their befuddlement, their confusion when I explained that the podcast with a K is called the podcast with a K, because obviously to them the podcast with a K is the wrong name because podcast begins with a P. So why isn't it called the Codcast? And obviously I said, well, because we don't talk about fishing. Which is, if you were doing a fishing podcast, that's a brilliant name, because you've got two things there. You've got cod and you've got cast.
Yeah.
And it's podcast with a K, because just in case there's someone listening who doesn't get this, and I doubt there is, because we spell it with a K instead of a C in the second syllable. Just wanted to just throw that out there, just make sure that there was no sort of like wider confusion beyond the local Labour Party. So, guys, X-Files, you're kind of leading on this podcast, really, aren't you? So the X-Files is coming back next year, isn't it?
Yes. I don't know what it is in the UK, actually. I'm kind of curious if you guys get a simulcast kind of thing going on. But here it starts January 24th and 25th. So Sunday and Monday, they're airing episode 1 and 2.
Well, so that's quite soon. Then, it's a month. We're just 6 weeks away, aren't we? 5-6 weeks away.
Yeah, we're not that far away, for sure. So, yeah, they keep doing screeners, of the first episode. And I have this one friend who's very excited, but also in some way slightly annoyed. He's one of those fans, as we all know so well. But he keeps sending me emails saying, like, oh, I just read this spoiler online. I know you don't want to know about spoilers, but, man, it has me fuming. And it's like, okay, you're baiting me. You want me to ask you about it, but I'm not going to ask you about it because it's just freaking next month, you know? But so it's getting one of those things. It's hard to kind of avoid the spoilers, but it's so close. So I'm trying to do it. What is it in the UK? Do you guys know when it starts in the UK?
I have no idea. I should know. I have a feeling. I have a feeling Sky bought it in the end, if I remember rightly. There was a bit of an
acquisition. No.
Yes.
Wait. No. Is there a Channel 5? Channel 4?
I'm
like
pretty
that?
Sure.
I think that's familiar.
I don't think they got it. I'm pretty sure that it was
Channel 5. It says here.
Is it Channel 5 actually got the rights to it?
There you go. Well, yeah. I thought it was Channel 5. Yeah. Channel 5
corrected.
I'm baffled that no one prepared this bit beforehand.
Frankly. But you know, it's funny. I actually just read this the other day, so I should have even had it in my memory there. But I don't see a date on it though.
Well, Channel 5, obviously, for those who don't know, and Brian won't know this, Channel 5 has the advantage of being owned by a pan-European conglomerate. So they have got the money to sort of challenge Sky in many cases. So that, and this is obviously one of the ones that one of those cases. So yeah, Channel 5, that'd be interesting.
It's only the news only broke 4 days ago, so you can't really blame me for not knowing. I mean, if I actually read my friend's website once now and then, I would have known. But
I don't know. Who was it just said they were talking about this yesterday on another podcast?
We talked about the X-Files. They are an American podcast. They weren't interested in this small, insular little country which thinks it's bigger for its boots than it actually is, especially maybe on foreign policies.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, it was that, that was where I heard it. Originally, it was a big war, according to TV-wise, between Sky One and Channel 5 and a few other broadcasters. BBC dropped out pretty early on, I think, in the bidding war. But it looks like Channel 5 took it, which is a surprise. But there you go.
So is Channel 5 good over there? I mean, you guys on Channel 5?
No, Channel
5. Channel 5's a kind of a bizarre mix of sort of ITV and BBC 3, isn't it?
It is. It's sort of like... it's sort of like if you had I've got to be careful what I say here, because again, it's going to sound really rude, but it feels like it's like a dumbed down child of Channel 4 and ITV, as if they had the child and the worst of their genes came together to create Channel 5, which sort of has the bit of both. It sort of
course, back in the day in the UK, the X-Files was on BBC One, wasn't it?
It was on BBC Two initially.
Oh, BBC Two, beg your pardon.
And then it became you know, what they call a cult hit, and BBC One acquired it from its sister channel for its and it did well. It managed to keep its ratings, because that's always the worry, of course, when you go from a niche channel to the mainstream one. Yeah, and it did well.
And then later on it moved to Sky, didn't it?
Yeah, Sky took it and sort of did its long repeat runs, and it sat on Sky since then. That's why I think, I presume, Sky had actually won the war for it, because it's largely been associated over the last 10 years with Sky.
Mm-hmm.
But we were saying in the last podcast that one of the interesting things about X-Files is that it sort of has a weird 90s crossover with Doctor Who, because it was a time when Doctor Who had gone, and the really science fiction was in an odd state in the 90s. It was sort of a start and go sort of thing. There was stuff which was working, and there was a lot of stuff which was just failing. And I think we were kind of looking to see where that sort of model of Doctor Who could reappear. And when the X-Files reappeared, a lot of people thought, this is kind of what I thought Doctor Who could do if it came back now. Something which didn't have to be space. It could be monsters. You didn't have to see the monsters. The whole way that it was, that the X-Files worked, felt like was a good template that Doctor Who could have done. And I still think the McGann series, McGann TV movie, do you feel that there's a sort of slight riff, certainly in the tone and in the lighting? There's a hell of a lot of blues.
Well, was there not a similarity with where they produced it? Was not a lot of X-Files shot in Vancouver?
Yes, that's true.
Yes. Yeah, and so, you know, I wonder how many, like, crossover of crew there may have been, like, people used to that sort of thing. But certainly at the time, you know, one of the things we should talk about, I guess, in relation to that, is how groundbreaking the X-Files was at the time. You know, their use of lighting, their use of production, in the respect that each week they were making a movie rather than which was just the regular TV kind of style of filming, which was just bright lights everywhere, usually. You know, the camera angles and the shots that they blocked and the time they took to actually make their show, they were making a movie. As Chris Carter often said, they didn't know what they weren't capable of doing or what they couldn't do on the show, rather. And so they just kept pushing the boundaries. And so therefore, it was the show that kind of changed the face of TV after it. And so therefore, Doctor Who kind of emulating that made a lot of sense. But it also, as you were saying, James, made perfect sense, because Doctor Who could have easily, and as we've seen now, definitely could have gone that way, although they're showing us the aliens still, which still kind of makes sense for Doctor Who to me, rather than the X-Files, where everything was so peripheral. But definitely there was a cross-pollination there in style, and I noticed that directly when I watched the TV movie for the first time. And I had been a fan of that point, because that was 96, and I guess I'd been watching the X-Files for about 3 years then, 2.5, 3 years by the time that came on.
There was a feedback loop into Doctor Who, which in 94 and they did a couple. They did Probe. Well, no, sorry, I should rephrase that. Doctor Who didn't, but fan companies associated with Doctor Who, which had a lot of the actors and production people on board that were creating things like Downtime and what was the Centauran one called?
Shakedown.
Shakedown, thank you. Probe was another one of those unofficial Doctor Who spin-offs, which dealt with a sort of, some say, you could argue it's sort of like was Torchwood in the 90s, but was obviously riffing off the earthy monster of the week sort of vibe of the X-Files that was started a year earlier. So in a sense, you could see what Doctor Who was doing with that sort of format.
Was The Stranger not doing that as well, though, in a way? Because that was another one, wasn't it?
Yeah. The Stranger, I actually liked The Stranger. It was a bit more surreal in tone than most of the other stuff was.
Wasn't The Stranger, like Probe, didn't The Stranger predate X-Files?
It may have done, actually, now you say that.
Did it?
Yeah, so The Stranger, that was Davison and Pertwee and Baker, wasn't it? Colin Baker.
Yeah, I'm just having a look.
As his Doctor-style character.
91 doing... was the first one, so...
Right.
Get out, okay, so yeah.
2 years.
Now, granted, The Stranger was supposed to be subtly their kind of take on the Doctor actually becoming a hermit in, what was that story, The Twin Dilemma, when he recommends that he should stop traveling in time and go be a hermit and live in the desert. And that's where they picked it up, you know, with he and Perry. That was the whole point of the Stranger series, was what if he really did do this, and then we can go ahead and do stories where he's not calling himself the Doctor anymore. So it was a little weird in that respect, and then of course it grew into its own thing, but it was definitely a very surreal storytelling kind of experience, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun.
So anyway, but yeah, so I mean, there's certainly cross pollinations within the ideas of X-Files and Doctor Who. Especially, I suppose, also, I mean, while the X-Files would kind of like to, you could almost say the X-Files precursored some of the new Doctor Who, in the sense that you have a very more even relationship between the lead male and the lead female. I mean, I would still say that Mulder is the lead character, but Scully still has an extremely relevant part of that combination, and I think that's very much where they push Doctor Who into that same sort of synergy. Yes? No?
Yeah, I could definitely go with that. And I was just thinking when you said that, I was trying to think. For years, I had felt the same, that like Mulder was still. I'll put it to you this way: the show probably wouldn't have happened without Mulder's character, because I don't see anybody else in that universe going after the paranormal things that he did quite the same way that he has. It was his drive, his devotion, and his beliefs that did it. But obviously, as you get later on into the series, Scully actually does turn into the lead character at that point. I think what it is actually, I guess the best way to say it is, in the beginning, it's as you said, you know, Mulder is the lead character and Scully is sort of that companion kind of thing, even though she's, in my opinion, still one of the best and strongest female characters ever written on TV. She did start off as that kind of sidekicky kind of thing, but then evolved slowly into this partnership. The show was kind of equally about them, I had felt. And then it moved on to when Duchovny wanted to leave the show, that she took over the reins and did a damn good job of it, in my opinion. But I definitely think you're right. I think it was like a precursor to setting up a companion type, a strong companion type for the new series.
This was something I was saying yesterday on a podcast that I won't name. We're talking about the X-Files. Is there an argument, and this is not to say that, especially since I've talked to these fellows, so I'd feel bad, sort of, I'd feel traitorous to suggest this in a negative way. Is there an argument that, and a hypocritical way maybe, given our podcast, that after 9 years of a show with 26 episodes and 2 movies, when you come back to revive it again, is there a feeling a little of indulgence of format? Now, I know the first thing someone would say is, well, isn't this a Doctor Who podcast? How many years has that been going on for? But you right. could, you would almost be like saying, well, if there'd been sort of like 9 years of Christopher Eccleston and Rose, and then 2 movies, and then a film, or sorry, then another mini-series. Where do we stand? Should we be looking at television as sort of something where, if it becomes, something becomes over-mined, do we sort of say it's like a soap opera, and you know that's not a problem. Viewers can drift out and then drift back in when they're engaged. It's not up to the show to feel that it has some obligation to be shorter, because it might be considered over-milked, as some tabloids would say. Or is there an issue where shows should could be considered shorter to allow other shows exposure and room to try new ideas? See where I'm getting at? You know, we've had a hell of a lot of X-Files, and I suppose what gets me a little is that X-Files fans have been very, very vocal over the last 10 years about getting X-Files back again. And it's a kind of sort of feeling I sort of think, but you know, there's so many shows which don't even get two series or three series. Mm. You had 9 series and 2 movies, and you want the show back. Would Doctor Who fans be doing the same, and should they be doing the same if that was the same case, though? Is it wrong to argue against that? I don't know.
Technically, Doctor Who fans did do that. You know, they lobbied for years to get the show back, and you know, made more books and radio dramas happen and so on out of all of that. And
then started working in the industry.
And then started there you go. The industry.
Yeah. But with the X-Files, it's a little bit different to me in the respect that with Doctor Who, it was more so, you know, we love this show, we miss this show, we want this show to be back, where I believe that's true of the X-Files as well. But the X-Files also left some things unresolved. Right. And so that's something that fans have been wanting to see resolved for a while. Not only, like, obviously I would like to see more stories with them. I'm a firm believer that they should have used the second movie, and I understand why they didn't use the second movie for this. And it was really budget restraints at the time, not allowing them to do what they wanted. So they made it seem otherwise. But I'm a fan that the second movie should have ended the mythology. Just totally finally put an end to it and gotten the answers there, because you can then tell a whole host of other movies afterward, or even as they're doing now, a miniseries of just Monster of the Week stories, because they do it so well. If you just want to go watch a monster story or a slightly scary story or even a slightly silly story with a monster in it, they just do that storytelling so well, and you don't have to be a fan of the show to watch one of the Monster of the Week stories and understand what's going on. You know, that you find out what you need within that story itself.
Explain this to me, and I mean this in a very genuine way. What in the mythology did they not end up wrapping up? Because I got a kind of feeling that even though it wasn't like a serious conclusion, that they did sort of pretty much bring closure to the conspiracy arc, didn't they?
Well, no. Basically, in season 6, rather, they kind of spelled everything out for us and kind of took care of the main conspirators, in a sense, which supposedly was supposed to be the end. But then the show kind of evolved from there even further, because the main one, the cigarette-smoking man, he survived. When you get to season 9, we learn that this alien invasion that's coming to Earth, and for those of you, you know, trying to avoid spoilers, sorry, but hey, the show's been off air for quite a long time now. But
it might actually help them when coming to see the new miniseries.
Well, what's interesting about the new miniseries is that, you know, they're doing what Doctor Who did. They're making it for new viewers, but they're trying to stay true to the old ones as well. However, they are also taking the mythology apparently and flipping it on its head. And this is the one thing that my friend is a little upset about and something that I'm concerned about. Me, I don't mind flipping things on their head so long as I can still reconcile what was said in the past with what's being said now. As long as I can understand where the bouncing ball went, I'm okay. But in season 9, basically what we got was the answer to colonization, alien colonization of the Earth, and these conspirators from Earth that were working with them. And the date was set for December 21st, 2012. So prior to this miniseries happening, the 2008 movie would have been a great time to address that, because you could have easily set your movie in 2012 if you wanted to. Or just kind of dealt with it and ended it early. But that's the part of the mythology that is unresolved, is the fact that this alien invasion is looming over us. And Mulder and Scully know about it. And how do you stop it in a world where people just don't believe it? You know, now it's after that date. So Chris Carter has said that they will address colonization, but he's not sure if it's in a big way or a small way. And that's possibly part of the reason for changing the mythology in this new miniseries, is that giving it a new direction, a new twist to kind of explain why colonization didn't happen. Was it ever real? Is it real? Was it postponed? You know, we're going to find out the answers to that. But those are the things that the fans wanted to see, the end to this story. You know, that mythology drove the show. It's running arc, which basically TV shows today, every episode is a running arc. The X-Files just did random episodes, key episodes, the big episodes, their season, each season rather, was mythology building to this story. And that kind of really was born at the end of season one when Gillian Anderson became pregnant and they needed to write her out of the show. And this whole mythology was born. But they took it somewhere. They were driving it somewhere. They were drawing us in with it each week, and we didn't get the resolution. And that's what we want is the resolution of that story.
I thought the resolution was that the link for colonization was the conspiracy. And when in the end of season nine, that is pretty much utterly obliterated, including the cigarette smoking man in theory, that link for colonization was lost, which is why I always assume the mythology had very loosely tied itself up by removing that. Correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a long time since I've seen season nine.
Sure.
Since it aired.
Yeah. Basically at the end of season nine, here's what we're going to have to learn for season 10. Let's put it to you this way. We saw Cancer Man die by getting shot with like a nuclear bomb, a missile yes. of some sort, yeah, maybe yeah. nuclear or just a missile. But we saw him melt, like we saw people melt in the Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know what I mean? So they got to explain that. But hey, if there's alien technology at play, I'm willing to buy into it. If it was a clone, I'm willing to buy into that. You know, like it's I have a very active imagination in there, and there are certain things that I can really suspend my disbelief for. But I'm really curious to see how they're going to do that one. But how we left it at season nine was that Cancer Man was gloating to Mulder and Scully that colonization is set, the date is set, and there's nothing you can do about it. So Mulder and Scully go off and they leave knowing that there's this looming threat, but we don't know how to stop it. There's alien replicants all throughout the world who have taken over key positions in our government just by being alien duplicates of humans. And I really, honestly, right now, I'm hoping that I'm not losing new fans who want to check out this new series, because I promise you, Chris Carter said this was for new viewers and you won't be lost. So please bear in mind what I'm saying here right now is you don't necessarily need this to dive into season 10. But this is just what we want resolved.
This is what's always very interesting when you do any sort of continuation.
Right.
And this applies the same for Doctor Who as well. Is that you take a risk as a viewer, as a consumer, there is a risk involved that what is produced may tarnish your conceptual idea of the show that you enjoyed. There's always that risk. You're going to roll the dice. That
oh, yes.
You want
yes.
a new Ghostbusters. You get a new Ghostbusters. You know, that's going to be your choice whether you watched or not. I mean, I still think that while Chris is pitching this to new fans, I still think that it's going to be a hard pitch for new fans. And this, again, was what I was talking about yesterday, is a bit like the Beatles. How the Beatles were a phenomenon in their time, but after 50 years, when you've had so many people build on that phenomenon and even recycle it, like British bands like Oasis, the actual spectacle is lost through that replication. And to a certain degree, after The X-Files, while there was nothing that ever was quite like it, there were things which replicated or borrowed from that format. And I'll be interested to see whether, first of all, whether new fans will find it something fresh and interesting. And second, whether the fact that the leads, and this is a sad ageism thing which Capaldi fans will be aware
Shame
of.
Shame on
well,
you.
Will they buy into that chemistry, which we can't deny was a major factor in the X-Files' perpetual success in the mainstream.
Before Brian answers that, I just want to point out that the X-Files isn't the only show coming back, because there's also Heroes coming back, and the difference with Heroes is that they're doing it without a key character. The cheerleader played by Hayden Panettiere. They're kind of retooling in a different sort of a way themselves. So it'd be interesting to compare and contrast how each show executes its revival.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, and the one thing I will say is, you know, you have to remember too is that the X-Files for season 8 and season 9 did introduce new main characters already. They already tried the route of let's revive this show with new leads. And in my opinion, season 8 worked really well because Mulder's absence was felt throughout. It was the whole point of the season that they were trying to find Mulder, who had been abducted at the end of the previous season. Season 9, unfortunately, is where things fell flat for me. I appreciate it more now than I did at the time. But you have two leads who are trying to pick up a show where the others left off, rather than, in my opinion, it should have been something like, say, X-Files New York, you know, how CSI New York or mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. that exists, where they could have just told stories of other agents dealing with other random cases, and it would have just been a spinoff and worked, because the characters weren't bad. Well, I really like Doggett. Reyes left me a little flat, but she has her moments where I think she shines, and one of them was in the finale of the episode, of The Truth of Season 9, which is really good. But her performance is really good, I should say. But I think that's what's so great about this show is that they didn't sit there and say, hey, let's go ahead and build X-Files The Next Generation. They did try and bring them back. Now, granted, there's some talk of some characters within this miniseries that may be building or setting up to X-Files The Next Generation, but we'll see how that really does go. The whole ageism thing, I don't get that. Like, for me, I'm one of those guys that, you know, if Harrison Ford wants to do another Indiana Jones movie, I say let him. I don't care because he's freaking Indiana Jones and I want to watch it, you know? But Mulder and Scully, certainly watching David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson now and all the trailers and the clips and the previews, I think, number one, they look fantastic. Number two, I think the both of them have grown tremendously as actors, yeah. And I'm dying to see what they're doing in this miniseries with that.
We're talking about new viewers, not old viewers. Well, we are actually still talking about... No, I mean, old viewers, I think, are their chemistry is what makes the show. I mean, there's a lot of X-Files True. Fans who are, as we know, very focused on their dynamic, and from what rumours have said, have been very annoyed about how their dynamic's being treated in this new series. But what I'm Right. saying is that new fans who will be used to industries approaching lead characters as being youthful, vibrant people they can connect with won't, as you could argue they were, X-Files were back in 93 when Duchovny and Gillian were started the role, will they carry that same, will they be able to connect with these characters fresh off the bat as middle-aged characters? That's what I
yeah,
mean.
Yeah, no, I see where you're coming from. Yeah, and that will definitely be something. I mean, it's very hard to say. It's one of those things you're going to have to wait and see. My kind of hope is that, you know, there starts to be a sway where we don't need to see teenage leads as FBI agents, yes. You know what I mean? Like I want to see people just like, well, I mean, when you think about it, they're FBI agents, you know, and you know, yeah, easily they could be in their 30s, probably even late 20s, whatever you want for that kind of position, but you know, they're seasoned FBI agents, and it does make sense that their age would be what it is right now, and hopefully people would take that kind of context into account. But it will be interesting to see. I am very curious. The two main things I'm curious about is I have heard rumors about what's happening to the mythology for us classic fans. I've heard the rumors about the relationship between Mulder and Scully. And to be honest, that sort of thing doesn't really bug me. I know The X-Files is the show that actually created the term shipper and shipping. And while I was always okay with it, their relationship, I'm okay with where he's taking it to in this new series. I kind of have faith in what he's doing. But the mythology is where I'm a little bit more concerned, because from what I'm hearing, and I don't want to spoil anything, but from what I'm hearing, it sounds like I'm going to have a hard time reconciling it with what they gave us in the past. And that's where things will fall apart for me. If you take things and drastically change them too far, that what we learned is now meaningless. It's going to be a problem for me. But
this
new
is
viewers...
always, this is always the risk of new of bringing back old universes, is that you
yes.
change how, and I think it's kind of funny for me that those X-Files fans, and I don't mean this in any demeaning way, because however whatever you take from a show is absolutely fine, that's your subjective point, but
sure.
those who are very very focused on their relationship, in a sense, those who sort of push for a new X-Files series, you think, well, maybe you should have just left it at X-Files 2, which had them end in a sort of very happy place for the pair. That
right.
seemed to culminate what that particular invested fan wanted. And unfortunately, when you push for more, you take the gamble that what you get might actually not sully what you had before, but you lose your happy endings. Because inevitably, as soon as you bring anything back, you've got to create drama, and drama means you have to take away any happy equilibrium.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well,
Yeah, I mean, you definitely have the whole relationship aspect, which is certainly going to upset a large section of the fan base, which I personally think is the most vocal section on the internet. I don't think it's the largest representative of the fans out there, but I think it's the largest representative of the internet fan base. I think also too is that much like when Doctor Who came back in 2005 and we were all upset about a leather jacket and a buzzed head for Christopher Eccleston, is that, you know, we are too vocal, we are too mouthy about the things that we think are right or wrong. And I think we should give Chris and David and Jillian a chance, because if David and Jillian are thinking this is right, where we're going here is right for their characters, who are we to argue with that? And I also think that later on in the series, things may end up very differently than how they begin. You know, you got to give it a chance. But there are people out there like boycotting this series because they don't start as a married couple. And to me, it's just silliness.
Gillian Anderson has done a really good job in choosing her roles post X-Files.
Oh, yes.
So there's just, you know, there's a bit of condescension there. It's quite patronizing, isn't it, towards the actor and the actress concerned that they don't know what they're doing.
Exactly. I completely agree with that.
Or as professional actresses, they should really be that. It's up to them to allow whoever is driving the creative show to do what they feel is right with the characters as well. I mean, she'll have faith in Chris Carter. Well, it's going to be Chris Carter inevitably who's decided where these characters should be. I would like to quite see them in a relationship, just because. Not because I have any investment in them in a relationship at all. In fact, I was always very pleased when very early on in the X-Files, Chris Carter's statement was that these two would never get together, because I thought that's fresh.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's cool. I like that. And it's nice to see two characters that can just be friends, which a lot of people in male, female, in policing roles are and have to be, and create bonds without having to fall into sexual encounters. But at the same time, we don't get many middle-aged heroic characters who can be allowed into relationships because, you know, we don't want to imagine people who are slightly older having sex. And so in a sense, I kind of like them to be in a relationship just to defy that connotation that television has. That, you know, sex is, you know, people, they can be sort of married. But I mean, I don't want to see them having sex. Or I'd never wanted to see them having sex as simulated sex as young people either. I don't care. But I kind of like that idea of showing that you can have relationships in mature relationships in hero characters. But anyway, sorry.
Right. No. I honestly, I'm with you. Like when he had said that years ago, I thought the same thing. I thought, perfect. Just let these two. The one thing that Mulder and Scully had that you don't get in a lot of shows, certainly not in that era, and even now, I want to say, is that they had a mutual respect for one another. Yes. They would go to bat, they would do anything for each other, but they didn't try to put each other down or outdo each other. And the one thing that I take issue with a lot of shows now where they have a strong female lead and a strong male lead is there's always like a one-up kind of nature to them. Like they always kind of feel like it's a competition what they're doing together for some reason. Whereas with Mulder and Scully, it was just this complete 100% respect for each other. If they disagreed, they would definitely say they disagreed, and they had their facts to back it up. But for the most part, they backed each other up, and you never got a sense with Scully that anybody, except for like a couple random episodes where they wanted somebody to be hated for this particular reason, that there was ever a feeling that, oh, you're just a woman, you can't do this, you know, that, and it never even came up that she was a woman. She was a doctor, she was a scientist, so Mulder trusted her, period, on that alone. And sex never came into it, and I don't mean, you know, the act, I mean the gender, never came into it, you know, and it was just great. It was a perfect relationship. When they did eventually kind of make them have a relationship together, it technically brought them to, it was building, it was slowly building, and it was perfect that it was slowly, it was peripheral. But then it kind of came to fruition in like season 8, and I was okay with it. By that point, it was like, fine, you know, it was so peripheral for so many years, it's okay. But like you, I never needed to see the physical aspect of it on screen. I don't really think that needs to be there. It was the same way with Doctor Who. It wasn't the point of the episodes that you were watching. It was a different story that we wanted to see. You know, that aspect can be there, but we don't need to see the bedroom. And that, unfortunately, is what too many of the shippers want. You know, they're angry.
Especially not Nissa's bedroom.
Yeah, God.
But that's interesting, is it? I think what's always got me with those sort of issues is that it becomes the act of watching becomes almost an act of voyeurism rather than an act of narrative engagement. Because in life, I know a lot of people, and I know people who are couples, and I've not once seen them in the bedroom, and never really wanted to either. So why is it on television that we need to go that one step further in a sort of voyeuristic capacity? I mean, I watch Neighbours as people snort at me, and you always have those silly, jokey moments where the kid will accidentally catch the two, the mother and the boyfriend in the laundry room, and suggestive, things like that. It's that. Well, why? It doesn't happen. We're not interested. It's not funny. It's not. It's voyeuristic, and you're doing a voyeuristic thing through a child as well, which feels even more creepy. So yeah, I kind of like that with the X-Files, and I like what you said, because I agree with you as well, is that as a woman character, she exhibited very few gendered traits, unlike say Doctor Who, where there's always a lot of push for the sort of sassiness. I'm not just a girl, I'm something more. There's always that sort of push on the gender front, and yet the strength in gender comes from not having to acknowledge it.
The whole bedroom thing is weird. It kind of spreads across everything, doesn't it? Every genre, virtually. Yeah, it is strange. It puts me in mind of the year of the Sex Olympics, which kind of predicted the rise of reality TV, because reality TV again is voyeurism.
Right, exactly.
Very.
Reality TV too is the thing. Like when the X-Files ended, I didn't pick up any new shows after that because it just all turned to reality TV, and it was kind of like, what the hell? There's nothing good on TV. Like reality TV, really, that whole voyeurism thing just kind of killed TV for a while for me.
But that
Long
voyeurism
while.
thing goes beyond reality TV, and
Certainly.
I mean, there's academic in the 70s, Mulvey. She was very famous for an article where she was sort of saying how women are used as a sort of a voyeuristic sort of window gazing of the for the males in a show, which suddenly breaks up stories, and it does. You're right. I find it deeply frustrates me. I'll be watching a story, and a woman will come on into the show. This is more in film, to be honest. And my first reaction is, oh my God, it's a woman. Because I'm thinking, not that this woman's going to be an interesting character, I'm thinking, how's this woman going to displace the narrative with a story about how this man wants to sleep with her? And this male patriarch journey to bed this woman, which we've got to go through, and it's like, I don't want this. I came to watch this, and
It's
now,
funny you should say that because I was watching Prometheus last night,
yeah.
where basically that exact thing happens.
Well, that's it, and you get frustrated, and you feel sorry for the, you feel sorry for the female gender, and you feel sorry for the actress, because you feel you're actually being used to distract from what we're here to see. If I wanted to see that, I'm sure there's 100 porn channels I could watch, or romance books if I wanted that. And this is what I've always loved about Japanese film and television, is that there is a tendency, I've noticed in my experience anyway, that if it's about romance will play heavily. If it's not about romance, you very rarely get heavy romance B arcs. They don't really exist. Relationships will exist, but they're not focused on. The focus will be on the story. It seems to be far more categorized like that, and that really works for me, because I don't like having to sort of feel that as soon as I see a pretty girl appear in a show, that I'm thinking that she's going to be used to get in the way of the story for my benefit as a man. So it's a really horrid patriarchal system that we've got, where women are used for window gazing, and X-Files didn't have that. People obviously enjoyed Gillian Anderson. She became hottest woman of the year for FHM one year in the world. I think it was classified hottest woman in the world. And that, okay, that's fine, but she wasn't used for that in the story, and she didn't exhibit those traits where the story was distracted by her beauty or the male's need to win her beauty. As you can see, it's something that gets me so annoyed.
No, I'm totally with you on that. I mean, to be honest, and that was one of the things that always just drew me into the show, and why I'm not, well, I shouldn't say it this way because I know a huge female fan base for this show, but you know, a lot of the female fan base for the show are shippers, it has to be said. But then there's another large group of female fan base that just enjoys the same thing, like this mutual respect. And I think what it was I said earlier that, you know, I still think that Scully is one of the, if not the strongest female character I have seen on film to date because of the way that they handled her. And like you said, they handled her kind of like in a genderless way where she was just that doctor scientist character. And it didn't have to be that she was a woman. You know, she just played the role of that scientist doctor. Now, granted, you know, gender types will come in with your characters no matter what, just by how they react naturally to things. But that is okay because that's the natural reactions. That's not writing to any kind of tropes or stereotypes or anything. And I just think that as much as I've said this before, I don't know if I said this on the podcast, but I feel a lot of the strong female characters that are in film or shows today, and I do want to say excluding one of the ones that I think is one of the current best modern female leads, which is from The Hunger Games, Katniss. I think they do her very well. I think that a lot of the female leads, the strong female characters, are where male strong female characters were in the 80s. You know, where they're perfect. They have no flaws. They're cocky. They have to one up everybody. Everything's great and perfect. But, you know, they're not where we are right now. Where we are, where male characters are right now, where they're starting to show flaws and issues. Now, Jessica Jones did a damn good job of that. I just finished that series, so I have to say that they just did a good job of that, where they are showing a flawed character. Female lead, and I think that's great. But I think that's just the issue. A lot of them, they're doing this over the top kind of thing, and it's a shame because when you have somebody like Scully who came before, where it's kind of like Scully and Mulder. The beautiful thing about the X-Files to me was the main thing Chris Carter wanted was he wanted these characters to be real. He wanted them to be proper FBI agents, and he wanted them not to be, you know. Gillian Anderson won that award for being sexiest woman alive. Well, that's awesome. And I think she became sexy because of who she is, and not that she isn't a gorgeous woman, which of course she is. But, you know, Fox wanted Pamela Anderson for the role, where Chris Carter said, I want two normal looking people in this role. I don't want sex appeal. I don't want, you know, Fabio or Gillian Anderson, not Gillian, Pamela Anderson in these roles. So he cast real people. He made them dress like real people. You know, he didn't make them dress all glamorous. And he just wanted the show, which was surrounded by the surreal, to be grounded in reality. And I think that was one of the best things that he did. And that's why I think these two characters, for me, still live on as some of the best and most well-written characters ever. I can relate to them both in many ways, which is really fantastic.
Isn't it funny how studios always look to cast people who carry generic or have garnered a sexuality, rather than noting that shows often imbue actors with sexuality. I mean, Matt Smith's a great example. I mean, how many times did we see on the internet when his face first appeared as David Tennant's successor? We go, oh my God, he's got a face like a brick, or you know, and all these various, you know, he's got a really weird face. By the end of it, he was considered, you know, a massive sex object because the character had imbued, had given them a different perspective, and he has got good features. I'm not for once saying that he's an ugly man who's been made sexual by the role, but the role has, in part, given him his sex icon.
That has helped. it's that whole first impression thing, you know, like if Matt Smith had been announced as the Doctor and nobody knew who he was and there were no photos of him, there would be no preconceived notions of him until he was on screen and you actually got to see the man act, you know. But instead, you know, first impressions are just the visuals that you go by. And remember, David Tennant went through that too. He was called Weasel Face when he first got the role, you know. And even Eccleston, you know, everybody was like talking about the ears and the nose. And it's like, it's just ridiculous. You have to know who these people are. And personally, you know, I've met Matt Smith, and I think I've said a million times on this podcast, he's one of the nicest guys ever, you know. And it's like, so all of that stuff, it was so undeserving to be thrown his way just on a physical appearance. Well, and forget the character that he played. The man speaks for himself. He's a freaking brilliant human being.
Well, David Duchovny doesn't carry generic hero features. And as you say, you know, Gina Anderson is quite small. She doesn't have generic female model features, but there is a sort of humanistic beauty to all these characters that we're talking about, which is it becomes strengthened by the action roles you see them in. And it's funny how studios are so reluctant to let people cast people who aren't conventional looking, in the sense that they will create the next look, which is what they all did in some ways.
Well, you know, it's weird too, and I had talked about this for years when I first started getting into a whole lot of British TV, and this is kind of sound terrible because I don't mean to make British actors sound attractive by any means, but what I always appreciated about British TV was that it seemed like people got hired on talent and not because the studios thought they were sexy. And that was something that I just always wished that we did over here, you know. And I never felt that like the British actors were unattractive, but it always seemed like there was more varied appearances rather than just the typical glamorous kind of thing that you see here in Hollywood. And I really appreciated that. And so I always appreciate when a show over here will do that, where they'll just hire somebody clearly based on their talent. And that's what the X-Files did. When Gillian Anderson came in and David Duchovny came in for the roles, Chris Carter fought for them. Matter of fact, he had to fight extremely hard for Gillian Anderson. And he was right to do so. And even when she did get pregnant at the end of season one, Fox came back in again and said, perfect, great, get rid of her, hire somebody new, leggier and blondier, you know? And it was just like, this is ridiculous. So he had to fight hard to keep her yet again. And it's just asinine, but he saw the talent in her. He saw the character that he had written in her. And that's what should matter, you know, and that's, I don't know, that's where I think often the shows that do so well are where the real strength lies. Not only do you have excellent writing, but you have people who really believed in the characters enough to cast them according to the material that you wanted to put on the screen and talent, you know, not just on the beauty.
No, I agree. I mean, I think it's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, look at John Sim for Life on Mars and Doctor Who. Someone who, especially if you compare to the Life on Mars in the US version, you've got someone who doesn't have, again, those sort of not even the sort of rugged action hero qualities. He's quite a thin framed man with quite a sort of next door sort of look to him as a face, and yet he becomes again an attractive character because you're able to. I think there's an interesting thing that a very beautiful person, naturally, when I say beautiful, I mean is in conventional, what we consider conventional beauty aesthetics, chiseled jaws or
right.
breasts, whatever you want to do. Obviously, not on the same gender, I doubt. But they sort of create a wall where people can't connect with them easily because they can't relate to them, because they don't know many people who look like that. They can't imagine what it would be like to talk to them. So if you get someone who looks like someone they might be able to meet, they can interface with them more and then perhaps even feel an attraction to them because they can interface with them. And there's not this barrier, this fantasy barrier. They become less window dressing. And I think the other good thing about that is it goes back to this whole idea of using romantic characters or using relationships as a reward. Is that the man is rewarded with the girl, and that's what.
Right.
And if they are something which is that looks beyond the viewer's expectation, like a fantasy, like a Pamela Anderson model, then that becomes more of a reward, doesn't it? Because they become more of a fantasy. They become more of an object rather than a person because they can't identify with someone who looks like that. So the reward facet becomes greater than if they look like ordinary people. Maybe you don't look, you judge them less as the person owed the reward of this fantastical object, and become people who you see as, I don't know, as in, You could write much on this, I'm sure, and I'm sure it has been written on it.
Okay. Well, what's brilliant about that, though, is what you said in the beginning about seeing how people will react to their age. You know, it brings us full circle back to that, you know, rather than casting the young, sexy types, you know, hopefully going back with your leads who, yeah, have aged, get like, guess what, people do. Hopefully that'll be another sign, you know, strength of talent and strength of writing again.
I hope so too.
Sorry, Christian, you were going to say?
Indeed, what I was going to say is let's wind it all back, because we're coming to sort of podcast, what's the best term for that? Peak podcast, and we're getting up to our usual sort of time limit area. So we've discussed the podcast, we've discussed the X Files, and more of it, more in a sort of a historical depth. So take me, for instance, who's someone who hasn't, as we said at the top of the show, watched a lot of X-Files. What is me, as the casual viewer, going to get from the X-Files? And we've already said that I don't need to have seen anything so far. So what are we going to get?
It's a good question.
It is a good question. I think basically, I put it to you this way. Remember how Doctor Who began in 2005, where there was so much history and people were afraid to know or what they should know or shouldn't know. And then, of course, they were handed the Time War, and everybody assumed that Time War was something real that they could go look up. I think you're probably going to see a little bit of the reverse of that, where if they start talking about the past, there's going to be a hint of Time War stuff where there's no real backing to it. It's all new, and then there's possibly going to be a little bit more truth in there that you can look up with the old series. But I think they're going to give you what you need to start from episode one of season 10 and carry on. The beautiful thing about it is the setup for this series is the mythology episodes are episode 1 and 6. It's a 6-episode miniseries. The episodes 2 through 5 are Monster of the Week stories. So you should need nothing going into those. You should really need nothing going into the first one. It should technically do the job of bringing you up to speed to get you where you need to be. Anything after that would just be extra information for your own enjoyment. And supposedly that's what it does. The screeners for season one seem to be apparently making fans like myself out there extremely happy. So I'm very curious to see what it's going to be like for new viewers, because I don't know how many new viewers were at screenings for these things. I mean, there had to be some because it was for the press, but what will you need or what will you be left out with? I don't think you'll be left out. I think they're going to help bring you into it. But certainly by episode 2, it should just be fun monster stories, something to really drag you into the creepy.
Okay.
And comedy, actually. One of them is a comedy, so at least. So, which should be up your alley.
It should indeed be right up my alley.
I don't think any preparation is needed for fans either, but if some of you are going through the 201 days of X-Files, I think that's brilliant. Hopefully you're going to be completely caught up before the series starts. But
or totally bored by it by the time it starts.
You know,
sick to hell of it.
Exactly. I was wondering how that would go, to be honest, but, you know, we'll see. But I, like I said, biggest thing for me, what are they doing to my mythology? I'm very curious to hear, Christian, your point of view when we do see the episodes air, because you don't really know the mythology as well as I do. And I don't even know if, James, I think you know the show well, but like you said, you haven't seen it in years. So I'm very curious to also hear your point of view. Go on.
I think what will be interesting to see is whether they're going to make the mythology more contemporary relevant. Because there is a difference in where conspiracies and where paranoia sits now to where it was in 1993, 1994. So I think that will be interesting, is if whether they're remodeling the mythology to suit a new audience, essentially, or the expectations of a new audience.
They did say that in this post-Snowden world, and certainly the show... A lot of people aren't aware of this because he didn't speak about it at the time. But the reason that they did actually decide to take the X-Files off air was Chris Carter's choice, because after 9/11, he kind of felt there wasn't room for a show like this on TV anymore. But now he feels with the post-Snowden years and so on, and the fact that the world is watching you through technology and we know that we're being lied to by the government, he feels it's time to bring it back. So I think you're going to get that. I think there's going to be a move to bring it into a more modern kind of aspect for sure.
Okay then. So, the X-Files, quite a bit like Doctor Who in some ways and completely different in others. Doctor Who's not going to be back for other than on Christmas Day, which we'll be talking about next week, for at least 9 months, 8 at a stretch. So, you've got the X-Files coming at the end of January, dear listener, to entertain you. And Ripper Street as well is back in January.
Yes. Well, they've done... I hate promoting this, but they Amazon have done a student offer where you can do 6 months on Amazon Prime for free.
Right.
And then a half price for the rest of the year. And that's and for the however long you're in your degree or whatever you're doing at university covers.
Right.
Before it goes to full price again, which is a rather smart and canny bit of work, especially if you consider 6 months from January leads you to the end of term, which means a lot of students will, if they finish their degrees, will go home and want to carry on their subscription, where of course they will perhaps be pushing their families to pay for Amazon. So in a sense, it's quite a smart, deft bit of marketing. But anyhow, yes, it's very good if you're a Ripper Street fan or you want to see Ripper Street. Or Spotnitz is a recent... What was his recent one called, Brian?
The Man on High Castle.
That's it. Which is also, I believe, Amazon linked. That's
and that's a very interesting premise, that. Yeah,
so, I'm going to be checking that out soon as well.
Frank Spotnitz being X-Files based... dear listener, if you didn't
know. Responsible for a lot of the mythology stories with Chris Carter in later years, but also some really good standalones as well,
and a very sweet man as well,
very friendly guy. Yes, absolutely.
So there we go. So Doctor Who didn't really get much of a talking to this week.
No, it didn't did it? It's I mean obviously we touched on those two videos.
Well, there was something that I think we should leave people with, which I think was fairly interesting. One of our colleagues mentioned a Twitter comment on the audience appreciation.
Erstwhile cast service writer Richard Forbes.
Absolutely, Mr. Richard Forbes, who always sort of finds some quite fascinating things to debate. And it was basically, I've not seen the actual breakdowns for the AIs, but the suggestion is from a Twitter post that he linked to, was that the 55 plus and men who constantly rate season 9 as lowest, and 16 to 34 women who rate it as highest. And his point was, does this sort of suggest a topsy-turvy on the argument that it is women who have been leaving, who are not happy with Capaldi, who have been leaving the show when they're obviously enjoying it? Which is an interesting argument, and I don't know where it goes, but it's something worth thinking about. I think the problem is with these... with audience appreciation and with any statistics, it is very hard to sort of discern patterns just from very basic breakdowns.
Yeah.
Unless you are the Sun, the Mirror, Daily Mail.
In which case you're magically able to.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the guy probably said, so can we stop this fallow with the shallow fangirls are to blame argument, which I think is a good argument to be putting down, because I think it is a rather pathetic niche.
Is it an argument, or has it turned into a bit of a shtick?
A bit of a shtick, maybe. But then, as I say, my mother's 60. She watched Doctor Who. She loved Matt Smith for the sexuality, you know, and she really didn't like Capaldi because, well, part of the reason, apart from she felt the writing went down, it has gone downhill, but she just didn't feel that connection she felt with Matt Smith. And so I think there's also a counter prejudice on presuming that fangirls are simply people between 16 and 34.
Mm.
And that is not true. So I think you've got to be careful on these sort of things. And of course, AIs don't tell you specifically who's leaving the show. They're just telling you the appreciation of those who are watching it. So it's vague things, but I think it's stuff worth to consider, especially if you're the sort of person who believes that fangirls are destroying Doctor Who for you. Like, well, maybe they're not.
Maybe they're not. Maybe it's just scheduling.
I think, yeah, I think we've got to still...
Or writing.
But, I mean, as I said in response to Richard, there is another issue that, you know, in theory, Doctor Who should be doing fairly well after 2 hours. In theory, and this is what I think the BBC had hoped, that 2 hours of Strictly would give Doctor Who a nice bit of variety changeover from people watching, you know, having a glut of reality, and therefore keep them from channel hopping to X Factor. And keep them with Doctor Who. And to a degree, X Factor has had a drop in figures. Not quite as bad as Doctor Who has had, arguably. But hasn't helped Doctor Who. Doesn't seem to have. So what is happening there? And who are the people who'll be watching? I don't know this. What are the demographic consistencies of the families watching Strictly and X Factor to Doctor Who? And do they relate who is watching what and who is losing what. It'd be interesting to see the audience appreciations for those three shows.
And are their children going to bed?
I think children is a major factor. I don't doubt that the late time, not just for children, but as I've said before, people see Doctor Who as being an early evening show. They're not thinking about it being on, or when they do, they're moving and changing their habits by 8 o'clock. So I think that's a factor.
Yeah.
But I do think there are internal factors, and I still think you can equate it to the whole Graham Williams, John Nathan Turner issue, that this last series has been very fan-focused.
Yeah, definitely.
I just don't know, if you weren't a fan, what you'd get out of that finale, quite frankly.
I don't even want to go there again. So that brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K.
Stabrous.
It's nothing... so that's this week's podcast. We're nothing to do with fish, but a lot to do with the X-Files. And next week we're not talking about Doctor Who really again either, because next week we're going to be talking about people like Captain Phasma and all those other great new characters in J.J. Abrams' retooled Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Yes, another we're going there. Hey,
another continuity, another return.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of continuity to talk about there. So, yeah, we're skipping Dot 2 next week. And then we're the week after that, we're going to be talking about the Christmas special. So, yeah, sue us.